We shall be informal today since it's an intimate audience. Not small, intimate, right? So I'm Michael Rodriguez. I think just about everybody in the room knows me, except for maybe you guys. I'm the subject collector for English and American Literature, Film Studies, and several other things. I'm also the coordinator for Humanities Collections, and these days, Digital Humanities. So I also coordinate library events, the library events series, so film, colloquia, and writers. So that's why I'm here, and I'm talking right now instead of John Beck, who couldn't be here. I think you all heard this, that his wife is getting a prestigious award in Philadelphia, so he couldn't. This is the only brown bag I think John has ever, in the whole time he's been doing these for like 13 years or even more, that he's never made it. Anyway, so the library, my sort of public service announcement for all these is, especially these brown bag series, is that we record all these. And talking about library services and collections, we record all the brown bags, especially for our daily work, our daily lives. So if you go into the catalog and look up our daily work, our daily lives, there's a series note, and you'll see all of them. And they're all from the catalog record for each one. You can stream the audio. So we collect the audio for all of these series, too. So we do that for just about all the colloquia series as well. Today, John wanted me to mention that the next brown bag is called In the Wake of Disaster, the Lake Erie's Association of Welfare Capitalism and Lake Erie's Black Friday Storm of 1916. Matthew Daly from the History Department of Grand Valley State will be here on Monday, April 14th, which is a week from Monday, right? And that one will be in the MSU Museum. Today, I just had the pleasure of meeting John Philippe. Is it Philippe?
Yep.
It's Canadian, so right? Yeah. Sorry. John Philippe Matthew is from the History Department in the University of Quebec. His talk is Labor Struggle in the United States and Canada, 1876 to 1878, Reflections on Connected Histories. John Philippe will give a talk, and we'll have question and answer, shortly after.
Perfect.
Okay. So please welcome John Philippe Matthew.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank the University of Michigan, Michigan State University. I just learned the distinction today, so please. Well, I'm on a roll now. So I'd like to thank MSU for inviting me to speak about a topic that's actually very dear to my heart, which is connected histories and trying to break down national borders when it comes to workers and the working class. I'd also like to thank Professor Beck, who is not here, but nonetheless, we've been talking about doing this since I met him 3 years ago at the Working Class Studies Association conference in Chicago, where I gave a version of what I will be doing today. I spoke about one of the three strikes that I intend to discuss today. However, in the years since I've done that, an article has been published about it. It's in French, though, so I will be spending a little time talking about it. But on further reflection, I realized that the strike in 1878 in Quebec doesn't really make any sense unless you put it into a broader international or North American context. So today, I'd like to talk about three strikes taking part in different parts of North America in a short period of time, so between late December 1866 and mid-June 1878. Now, the first two are generally well known. That would be the locomotive engineer strike in central Canada and the Great Railway strike in the United States. Now, the third, as I said, is the fruits of my own research, so I'll be spending a little more time talking about that, especially considering the article is only available in French. My aim in presenting this paper is to offer some reflections on how these three seemingly unrelated events are actually connected. In so doing, I will argue the history of working men and women in Canada and the United States frequently transcends national boundaries and is best understood in a North American rather than a national context. What I propose here are connected or crossed histories. I'm not comparing these strikes. What I'm looking for are contact zones, areas where different groups of workers or different groups of people interact. Railways are actually a really great example of contact zones. If you look at, this is a really jumbled map. This is what I found for 1877. And you can see this intricate web of railways that are crossing the border everywhere that it's possible to do so. These are areas where Canadians and Americans are interacting on a daily basis. We tend to forget that in North America, in the 19th century, the border is incredibly porous. Workers will cross without passports. They don't require visas to find work on the other side of the border. And especially with railway workers, they're crossing all the time back and forth. What I'm saying here today, and if I've done my job right, will sound obvious. But it makes it even more baffling that no one is really talking in these terms. Labor history is still stuck in these national units. We talk about Canadian workers and American workers. In this particular period, it makes more sense to talk about a North American labor market. Now, these are three examples, and I'm not even convinced they're the best examples. There just happen to be examples that I know fairly well. And what I'd really like, if I have a goal today, it's that my fellow scholars, when they look at the working class, they broaden themselves a little bit. I would like people to start looking at these in a broader context, in a transnational context. So as I said, the borders are incredibly porous in this period. You don't need visas, you don't need passports. One of the most important things unions are doing in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s is tramping. Tramping is when a worker, if he can't find work in, let's say, Windsor, he can just cross the border to Detroit. The union there, the union local, will give him room and board for a few days while he looks for work there. If that doesn't work, he just keeps going to another city. And we also tend to forget how well-informed people in this period were. Now, literacy rates were actually very high. Most adults read at least one newspaper in this period. Now, I'm not trying to say that workers see themselves in class terms over national terms. Patriotism, for example, is very strong. There's nativism, there's racism. In Canada in particular, you have language issues. But workers did tend to understand that they had more in common with their fellow workers than with their employers, and they always sympathized with labor struggles from across the border. Furthermore, those workers that were fortunate enough to be unionized usually belonged to the same unions. By the 1870s, local units had already given way to internationals, and we're talking about American internationals. Canada is considered on the same level as another U.S. state. They all belong to the same unions at this point, for those that are still unionized. Now, context is really important. In this case, the three strikes are taking place in the worst years of what was then known as the Great Depression, which lasted between the Panic of 1873 and, depending on your definition, 1879, 1880, things are getting better. And some have argued that the Depression lasts until the mid-1890s, when the economy really starts improving. Canada and the United States are going through the same issues. Now, the Great Depression is devastating for the labor movement, which had been picking up steam towards the end of the 1860s and the beginning of the 1870s. Most unions disappear. Now, employers, of course, are dealing with the Depression the same way that you would expect. They slash wages, and year after year after year, wages are getting lower. Now, one of the few places where unions are actually holding their ground are the railways. Now, this is because, unlike most workers, railway employees are not easily replaceable by what Marx would call the reserve army of labor, by the unemployed. You have to look at railway workers as sort of the high-tech, sort of the NASA scientists of their age. You can't just pick up an unemployed guy down the street and put him on the rails. So I'd like to turn to the first of the three strikes that I'd like to discuss. And that would be the strike of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers against the Grand Trunk Railway of Canada. Now, the Grand Trunk was designed to be a demonstration of British engineering and managerial skill. It was by a large margin the largest and most powerful company in Canada. And like most railways, it had a militaristic view of authority and discipline. During the Civil War years, when there was a legitimate threat of an American invasion, the Grand Trunk had actually organized its workers into brigades of infantry and artillery, which was foolish because if there was a war, those workers would have to drive the trains. But, the GTR, the Grand Trunk Railway, the GTR, was also a bottomless pit where Canadian taxpayer dollars were being shoveled. It never found profitability. It was sort of like GM. They just had to keep bailing it out. Now, in 1874, Joseph Hixon, who was a Scottish accountant, he was appointed as general manager, and he had a mandate to find profitability. And he did so by liquidating some of the GTR's worst liabilities. And he actually outsmarted William Vanderbilt by moving to the Chicago market. I'll just show you the... I cleaned up a map of the Grand Trunk's main route. If you see here, this is a Canadian company centered in Montreal, with its headquarters in Montreal, but that crosses the border. This is an international company. In this period, does anybody know what Canada's winter port is? Montreal and Quebec, the St. Lawrence freezes. Anybody have any idea what their winter port is? It's not Halifax. It's Portland, Maine over here. That's Canada's winter port. And when the Canadian government wants to build a railway to Halifax, question of Canadian unity, the GTR is actually adamantly opposed. Why would we need a railway to Halifax? We have Maine. This is a company that sees itself in international terms. And the whole goal of moving into the Chicago market was, of course, to capture the Midwest, try to funnel the Midwest through Montreal. So any story that involves the GTR has to take into account both US and Canadian workers. Now Hixon, I'll show you a picture of him. This is Hixon, good angle Scott. Hixon's search for economies would eventually fall on his workers, as anybody could have expected that it would. In 1875, he directs his superintendents to cut labor costs. Now, this aggressive cost-cutting would not only target lower-paid employees, but those aristocrats of labor, the locomotive engineers. Now, these workers were organized into the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, an American-based union based in Cleveland, which had weathered the storm of the Depression because of the irreplaceability of its members. The Brotherhood was very conservative. They did not like to strike. They promoted sober employees. They promoted dutiful members. They did everything in their power to avoid being seen as a problem for the railway barons. The Brotherhoods were incredibly powerful. I have a friend back in Montreal who works for the rails. He works for Via Rail. And there's a lot of old-timers at his work, people that have been doing it for 60 years and will probably die at their posts. And a lot of them used to be members of the Brotherhood. And so my friend was telling me about these ludicrous contracts, these collective bargaining agreements, that had things, just as an example, they had to have a potato knife on board. This was in their collective bargaining agreement. And I had to write this down when he told me because I thought it was great. This is to the extent that the Brotherhoods were imposing. One time, this old-timer had gotten onto the rails and he didn't have his potato knife. So he phoned into dispatch and I quote, "I told them no wheel is fucking turning until I get a potato knife." These groups are very powerful. Now in 1875, when Hixon tries to cut the wage scales, Peter Arthur, the president of the Brotherhood, travels from Cleveland to Montreal to meet with Hixon and succeeds in negotiating an agreement. This is Peter Arthur. He's another Scot, he's a Scottish engineer, and he heads the union. So already you can see the connections are being established. You have an international corporation, and you have a guy from Cleveland who was going to Montreal to negotiate a collective bargaining agreement for Canadian workers. Already you can see that it starts to be difficult to look at things in a uniquely national sense. In 1876, more cuts are announced, and Arthur travels to Montreal again to discuss with Hixon. A series of wage cuts in September in September of 1876 cuts wages, and in December another 20%. This would target the railways directly. Target the railways workforce. And Hickson takes advantage of this to rid himself of members of the Brotherhood, who were often senior engineers and could be replaced by cheaper men. Now, in this era, a strike was a gamble against impossible odds, but the Brotherhood, with its 10,000 members, was one of the few organizations still able to mount a successful campaign. Now, on the 26th of December, 1876, Arthur informed the Canadian leadership of the Brotherhood that he had ordered locals in Portland and Detroit that they were to support a strike. You have an American union leader in Cleveland ordering workers in Portland and in Detroit to support a union, a strike by Canadian workers. Once again, all of this is connected. Now, on December 26th, 1876, the Montreal members of the Brotherhood's Grievance Committee presented Hickson with a seven-point ultimatum. Without compliance, a strike would begin at 9 that evening. Hickson, of course, refused. The strike order was delivered all over the line by coded telegraph. By the morning of the 27th, the GTR was paralyzed all down the line. The first few days, the strike was generally peaceful. The Brotherhood's most powerful weapon was its ability to pay off strikebreakers. And the strikers also benefited by the GTR's intense unpopularity amongst the Canadian population. And if things remained peaceful, they had the public at their backs. It is important to note that not everyone was supporting the strike. Many areas were not off the job, but the vulnerability of trunk lines is that they can be paralyzed anywhere down the line. In the case of the GTR, that place would be the place would be paralyzed at Belleville, which is about here. No, actually, yeah, about here. Sorry. This is the only place where the local government calls out the militia to restore order. Now, beginning on the 30th of December, a crowd of strikers and sympathizers managed to hold off 40 armed militiamen and prevent them from using scabs to break the blockade. On New Year's Day, the blockade at Belleville still stood. Now, by now, Hickson is appealing to the federal government for troops, but the prime minister at the time was a strict constitutionalist, and calling out the militia is a provincial responsibility. So he hates strikes, but there's nothing he can do. Now, by the 2nd of January, now even the provincial governments had enough, and troops are being mustered to restore order. The blockade around Belleville is lifted by the militia on the 3rd, and it seemed like the engineers' cause was lost. However, what they didn't know is that on New Year's Day, Hickson had traveled to New York to discuss with his fellow railway barons. They discussed Cornelius Vanderbilt's declining health. The old Commodore would be dead within the week. But they also decided to end the rate war that was impoverishing them. They were all competing for traffic by having lower and lower rates, and so there was less money to go around. They had to slash wages. What they decided was to stop competing. The era of competition would end. Now it would be an era of collusion. There would be money for everyone. And Hickson decided to cut his losses, negotiate an end to the strike, go back to the old 1876 agreement. And he does this, as any good accountant, to avoid beginning the new era of collusion with a railway crippled by debt and labor strife. Now, I mentioned all these connections that are taking place, but for some reason, and these should seem obvious, but the classic study of the strike, it's by Desmond Morton. It's called Taken on the Grand Trunk. It's a great article. It's a classic in Canadian labor history, and I highly suggest it. But there's one single line in that entire article about American workers. And he says quite clearly that it does not appear that the American section supported the strike. Even a cursory examination of newspapers from, for example, Detroit, or even the New York Times, demonstrates that workers in Detroit did, in fact, join the GTR strike. It seems obvious to look at it, but for some reason, historians just aren't doing it. Being stuck in these national historiographies, these national narratives, makes it impossible to look at the full story. According to the evidence, actually, the line was actually paralyzed all the way from Detroit to Island Pond, Vermont. It does seem to be, from what I can tell, that Portland did not join the strike, but Detroit certainly did. It's also worth mentioning that the end of the strike came about because of an agreement between the Canadian Grand Trunk Railway and the American Railroad stopped competing. It's connected on every level between Canada and the United States, and yet historians are not looking at it on those terms. Furthermore, The victory of the locomotive engineers needs to be firmly placed within the context of the run-up to the next topic, which is the Great Labor Uprising. The Great Labor Uprising is fairly well known. There's several books published about it. I can highly recommend Philip Foner's book, just called The Great Labor Uprising, for more information. I'm just going to do a brief overview of it. It begins on the 16th of July, 1877, when workers on the Baltimore and Ohio Railway strike in protest of a second wage cut since the beginning of the year. Within a few days, the four major trunk lines and many smaller railways are shut down. Things begin to get out of control when some state governments decide to call out the militia to break the strike. In Baltimore, soldiers open fire, killing 11 people. That's the scene you see here. It's a classic image. In Pittsburgh, things get even worse. The local militia are fraternizing with the strikers, so the state government sends in troops from Philadelphia who kill another 10 people. The crowd, however, strike back and surround the roundhouse. They proceed to burn 39 buildings, 104 locomotives, 45 cars, 1,200 wagons. This is the conflagration you see here. They're setting locomotives on fire and pushing them in the way of the militia. In Chicago, the strike hits most of the city's major industries, and St. Louis is the site of the first general strike in U.S. history. This is one of the largest civil insurrections in the history of the United States after the Civil War, and I believe Blair Mountain in the 1920s. Now, it's worth noting that even after orders are restored on the railways about 45 days later, the uprising continues for several weeks in the nation's mining camps. Now, what I really want to concentrate on is some connections with what's going on in Canada. It's less known, actually, it's generally unknown, that the strike actually, the Great Labor Uprising actually did extend it to Canada. Of course, not to the violent levels of what happened in the United States. Foner mentions once in his book, The Great Labor Uprising, he has a list of railways that go on strike, and he mentions a couple Canadian railways in there. That is the only mention of Canada in the book. Now, one line clearly went on strike. It's called the Canada Southern. Canada Southern is a little bit like the opposite of the GTR. The Canada Southern was an American-based a railroad that functioned in Canada. It's one of William Vanderbilt's railroads, and it's centered in New York. So you see it goes here. The goal of this was supposed to extend to Chicago, but they never got there. They went bankrupt before. You'll see this is an American railway that's operating in Canada, and it does actually join the strike movement. This was incredibly worrisome for the Canadian authorities. There was an incredible anxiety that the violence in Pittsburgh was going to extend north. However, a compromise did end the strike after a few tense days. There was also a strike that was narrowly avoided on the Great Western. I'm not trying to say that the Great Labor Uprising tore apart Canadian society. It didn't. It was actually very limited, but it did happen in Canada. Once again, looking at things in a North American context instead of purely national context, you get a broader understanding of what happened. The border does not matter. And the fact, I'd like to also mention, just an aside, the fact that it didn't get violent in Canada is not to say that it couldn't get violent. As you'll see, there's no reason to suspect that the GTR wouldn't have the GTR strike wouldn't have gotten bloody if the militia had been called in, if that ended when it did. And contemporaries certainly worried that it was going to get bloody. So I'd like to talk about the third strike. I'd like to spend a little more time on this one, mainly because, as I said before, it's generally unknown. It's the fruits of my own research. And the article I published is in French, so it might be a good idea to talk about it in English here. Now, this happens in Quebec City. In the 1870s, this was a city in transition. For almost a century, its fortunes depended on two complementary activities, which was timber exports and shipbuilding. Now, the Great Depression was brutal to these activities. They do not survive the 1870s. Completely fall apart. Now, in an era bereft of a social safety net, the only option to stave off starvation were public works. Workers were at least fortunate that in 1877 and 1878, several projects were being undertaken. Now, the most imposing of these projects was the construction of the new Parliament buildings in Quebec City. The contract to build this was awarded to this guy, Simon Xavier Simon, who was a former Conservative member of Parliament. So a little bit of corruption in there. Now, taking advantage of the Depression, he hires his men at a pitiful 60 cents a day. This is very low even for the period. In May 1878, he goes further and slashes wages by another 10 cents. In protest on June 3rd, 1878, the ununionized men, it's important to note that these are not members of unions. Unions have not survived in Quebec City. These ununionized men constructing the Parliament buildings go on strike demanding a dollar a day, which was still very reasonable. Now, at the same time as this was going on, other workers on public works, in this case, the construction of the street railway, these are the first, I always find this interesting, these are the first public transit, which is just a railway car pulled by horses through a street railway. So there's workers that are constructing this on Saint-Jean Street in Quebec City. And they find themselves suddenly out of a job when the contractor fires them all to replace them with cheaper men. There's a skirmish. The replacement workers and the original workers join up and decide to join the Parliament building strike. So on June 4th, and led by a tricolor flag, which is probably a legacy of the Commune, the French tricolor was by then a symbol of revolution, 300 or so strikers began to parade through Quebec. Their objective was to force their employers to agree to pay $1 a day. Now, knowing that this was impossible if most workplaces continued to pay pauper wages, they decided on something even more revolutionary. They would force all major employers in the city to pay $1 a day, essentially creating a minimum wage. Furthermore, since from experience it was clear that the employers could not be trusted, they would force them to sign a contract binding them to pay these wages. This is important, and I'm going to come back to it later. The basic strategy over the next few days would be for the strikers to visit one by one all the factories, construction projects and shipyards in the city and force the employers to sign the contract. Failure to do so would lead to the workplace being forcibly closed and the workers chased away. On June 10th, the police was beginning to get wise and sent detachments to defend the city's major workplaces. A series of skirmishes take place and the strikers move from workplace to workplace, attempting to enforce a general strike. Now, I'll just set up a map so it's easier to see. This is Quebec City. This is the St. Lawrence, the St. Charles River. So by the morning of the 12th, the number of men on strike had gone from around 400 to between 2 and 3,000. Now, there weren't this many workers on the Parliament Buildings project and on the tramway project. Most of these are unemployed workers that are just demanding anything. A skirmish takes place at Peters's Mill. Peters's Mill is up here, the north of the city, and the city sends, finally the mayor sends 40 police officers and about 100 infantry and cavalry from B Battery. B Battery is a military unit in the city to break up the crowd. Now this is led by this colorful fellow. This guy is Thomas Bland Strange, which is one of my favorite names of any of the research I've done. He was not strange. He was actually a typical flamboyant British imperial officer. And he was certainly not bland. This guy was born in India. He was an imperial officer. He's been sent to Quebec. It's worth noting, as an aside, I always find this interesting because I don't, as a French Canadian, I don't usually say very nice things about the British. But the British in Canada, when it came to things like strikes, they tend to be a sobering influence because imperial officers like Strange didn't see it as their role to be the police. They were there to defend the empire. They were there to extend the empire. They were not there to act as policemen. So the police are taking position in front of the mill while the military moved in from Richardson Street right in the middle of the crowd. Strange orders the cavalry under Captain Short to disperse the crowd, but they are thrown back by an avalanche of stones. At around noon, Colonel Strange addresses the crowd, and I'd like to quote this because I think this is great. This is from a testimony when they were doing an investigation as to what happened. This is Captain Short. I saw Colonel Strange in the middle of the crowd and stones being thrown at him from every direction. I heard the colonel speaking to the crowd and ask what they want. And when one of them, apparently the leader, said, "We want work, we want bread. If we can't have work and bread, we want blood." Strange then offers to withdraw his forces if the crowd peacefully dispersed. The leaders agree, but as soon as the military was gone, the strikers rush Peters' mill, break down his office door, and order him to sign the document. The chief of police, probably scared for his life, tells him to sign, which Peters reluctantly does. That done, the crowd leaves with no further incidents. The strikers then gather in front of the parliament buildings, demanding to speak to the prime minister of the province of Quebec, Henri-Gustave Joly. He tells them that he obtained from the contractor a raise of 20 cents a day, effective immediately, providing they return to work. One of the strike leaders responds that it is not enough, and that the people are masters of the city, and that before they would accept such a price, they would take up arms. The crowd then marched down the hill. So they start off over here. They wind up. This is the old parliament. This is the new parliament that's under construction. So they go to the old parliament to discuss with the prime minister, and then they move down towards Mr. Renault's flower store. Now, he was one of the major, he owned several mills in the Quebec City region. He was a rich flower dealer. Seeing the massive crowd bearing down at him, Renault tries to reason with them, but he's pushed aside and his store is quickly looted. Carters are recruited to carry away over 200 barrels and 150 bags of flour, each cart escorted by five or six strikers, as the flour is spirited away to the working class suburb of Saint-Roch, which is up here. Much of the flour is subsequently resold at reasonable prices. I always find this interesting, the sense of a just price. So they're stealing all this flour, they bring it to the working class areas, and then they resell it, but at a really low price, what they see as a just price. Meanwhile, word reaches the mayor of the looting, and he quickly orders Colonel Strange to speed to St. Paul Street to restore order. At 2:30, Strange's detachment arrives by way of Mountain Hill. Mountain Hill is up here. His forces push the strikers back when they regroup around Dog Hill, a little to the south. Dog Hill is around here. Strange orders the cavalry to charge the crowd, and many men receive ugly wounds from the sabers. The strikers stand firm, however, and begin to pelt the soldiers with stones. The mayor then steps forward and reads the riot act, yelling as loud as he can that the troops fired in an instant. According to his testimony in the investigation, the mayor admits that the crowd probably didn't hear him read the riot act. Strange orders the infantry to fire. With the first shot, part of the crowd retreats, but most continue to pelt the troops with stones. Strange orders a second volley, and a dozen men are hit and two fall. One of them is killed instantly by a bolt to the back of the head. My feeling is that the British were probably shooting low, because according to the testimony, the subsequent investigation, the man that was killed to a shot to the back of the head was picking up a stone while he was doing it. So my thoughts are, once again, the British tend to be a sobering influence when these things are taking place. More incidents take place later that day. Most spectacularly, a group of men break into the mayor's home in order to lynch him, but the mayor escapes. The government begins to panic. 150 property owners are sworn in as special constables, and the lieutenant governor wires Montreal demanding reinforcements. And the state was preparing to mobilize every resource at its disposal to crush the uprising. On the morning of the 13th, both sides were preparing the day's actions. Three regular regiments had arrived from Montreal, while rumors circulated that a British regiment was being sent from Halifax. Meanwhile, the strikers were meeting at Jacques Cartier Hall. But a schism was developing. The radicals yelled that they would have bread or blood, but most of the assembled crowd hesitated to be the targets of the army's bullets. Most of the strike leaders advocated caution until the reinforcements had left the city. At 9 in the morning, one of the strike leaders is arrested. The strikers immediately surround the carriage, carrying him to captivity. Colonel Strange arrives and gives the order to two files to the right and left, ball cartridges, load, now shoot down the prisoner that attempts to escape. The crowd disperses peacefully. Now this signals about the end of organized resistance. The weight of almost 1,000 soldiers marching through the city crushed the strikers' resolve. On the 14th, the strikers begin to trickle back to work. The city authorities garrison regular army units around workplaces to prevent any further disturbances. The strike was essentially over. Although the strikers failed to impose minimum wage, something that would wait well into the 20th century, they did manage to draw attention to their plight and did gain 20 cents more an hour for their wages. So although it was a defeat, it wasn't a rout. Now this particular strike may seem to be an outlier compared to the other two I've talked about. These were not railway workers, nor were they technically an international workforce. Their employers were not international, they were for the most part the provincial government. Nonetheless, and this is what I realized in the years since I first published this article, I realized that the events of this June in 1878 in Quebec City is not understandable without referring to the Great Labor Uprising in the United States. Workers in Quebec are using precisely the same tactics as were being used in St. Louis and Chicago to enforce the strike order. And this is not just me seeing this. Contemporaries were quick to note that this was starting to look like what happened in Pittsburgh. I'd like to draw attention on one important thing that the workers do in Quebec. They try to force their employers to sign a contract promising a minimum wage. When I first uncovered this, I asked other labor historians in Canada if they had ever heard of workers adopting this tactic. No one had any idea where it came from. But then I started looking into the Great Labor Uprising, and I discovered that workers in at least one other place, Galveston, Texas, had actually done precisely that. So this is another less direct way that these strikes are all connected and how it's best to understand them in a North American context. Ideas are also flowing across the porous borders of the 19th century. The almost obvious criticism of this interpretation is that I'm assuming workers are borrowing ideas from other strikes instead of coming up with them on their own. This view would make the argument that coincidence is more likely than connection. This is possible, but I would argue that the idea of connection is more likely. To assume that it's a coincidence is making the assumption that the workers are ignorant of what's going on south of the border. This is quite simply not true. We tend to forget, as I said before, how well-informed workers in the general populace were, for that matter. As I said, literacy rates were very high in North America in the second half of the 19th century. Most people read at least one newspaper, sometimes two, and these papers had a lot of information. Although, more often than not, it's politically skewed information, but that's why they would read more than one. Just as an illustration of how well-informed people tended to be, many workplaces... Hired. Does anybody know what this guy's doing? Pardon? Supervising. He's not supervising. This is a cigar factory in Miami at the beginning of the 20th century. But the same thing's going on. The guy's not supervising, he's reading the paper. He's reading the newspaper for the workers. He gets paid by the workers, by part of their wages, and his job is to sit up there and to read the paper to them. And this is actually fairly common in factories. This is just an illustration about how people were actually very well informed. I'd also like to note one other thing. This is just an example of a newspaper from Montreal during the Great Labor Uprising. And they're all pretty much look like this. 19th century newspapers, usually the broadsheets are about 4 pages. Only one of the pages actually have news. The other 3 pages are generally ads. But what I've encircled in red is everything that's talking about the Great Labor Uprising in the United States, of what's going on in the States. And day after day during the strike, Canadians are being informed as to what's going on. So to say that they're not borrowing ideas is to assume that they're not informed, but they clearly are. Also, although the unions collapsed in North America, a lot of the unions fell apart, the union leaders, the people that were in the unions, are still there, and they are very well informed. Even though the organization doesn't exist, they still know how to make a strike, and they're still very interested to what's going on in the labor movement generally. And this is at the period where unions are at their lowest. When the economy improves the following year, around 1879, 1880, the unions come roaring back. And they become another vector of information for workers. For all intents and purposes, this is a North American working class. I'd like to just briefly conclude. My goal today was to offer some reflections on how confining ourselves to exclusively national historiographies does not allow us to see the whole story behind these complex events. The fact that American workers were involved in the 1877 GTR strike, Canadians did in fact strike during the Great Labor Uprising, and that workers in Quebec City adopted tactics introduced in St. Louis and as all places Galveston, Texas, will not radically change how historians view these events. They will, however, give us a more complete picture of what the workers involved experienced. This allows us to place American and Canadian workers who by their very proximity inhabited a single labor market into the same historical trajectory. Essentially, as I said before, I'm here to implore my fellow scholars and anyone interested in the history of working people to look at events such as those I've described in a broader context, to remember that for labor and for capital in the 19th century, the national border was very often meaningless. Thank you.
Thanks. So I understand the argument that you're making is that the cause for transnational solidarity resides in print capitalism. But to what extent do labor leaders in Canada and the United States engage in any kind of dialogue in those context sense that you mentioned? Or is there that conversation? Or does it owe strictly to what they read in the paper?
Well, as I said before, the unions that are alive in this period are all international unions. Local unionism more or less disappears in the 1860s. By now, they're all members of the same unions. So labor leaders in both countries are, of course, discussing all the time. Usually, this is the same leaders. Just to use the example I gave of Peter Arthur, who is an American, Scottish-American. He lives in Cleveland, where the Brotherhood is located. But he travels regularly to Montreal to negotiate on behalf of Canadian workers. By this period, it's all the same organizations. And when unions come roaring back in the 1880s, this becomes even more pronounced. The Knights of Labor, for example, the Knights of Labor are adamant in their in the fact that they're international. So by now, it's the same people.
I have a question. You talked about during the 1876 Grand Trunk Strike. This kind of blew my mind. So it ended because of collusion to keep wages higher. My mind just sort of turned around. The idea of big money capitalism colluding for the sake of higher wages just doesn't really.
Well,
what I was going to ask is are there other examples of this?
Well, the collusion isn't, the goal of the collusion is not to make wages higher.
The
end result is that it gives Hickson the breathing room he needs to make a deal, because the rates will get higher. There's no point in having the strike keep going when he can just pay it off. Hickson does not want to enter this new period of collusion, this new period of higher profits. He doesn't want to enter it with a railway crippled by labor strife and possibly bankrupt. He wants this to end and end now. So what he does is goes back to an earlier agreement. He just cancels some of the changes he made in 1876. There may very well be examples of collusion leading to higher wages. I don't really know of any. This wasn't the goal of the deal. This was just what Hickson needed to do to try to get the GTR back into profitability. He needed to end the strike now. Shame for him, because the Brotherhood was probably gonna surrender. They were gonna probably trickle back to work. Yes.
I'm trying to put together in my mind sort of a common pattern. And we had a speaker here a couple weeks ago who was describing union movements in the UP of Michigan, in which the people who owned the mines tried to import as labor a variety of people from a variety of countries in Europe so that they wouldn't get along with each other, so they wouldn't unionize, all right? That was the pattern described for that situation. Now, I get the impression from what you said that all these union people are happily working together and going against the government. And then another impression coming from a book published at MSU Press. They have a series on various nationalities in Michigan, in which one of them is the history of Scots in Michigan. Okay? And the first page or two singles out that group as being, despite their poverty from whence they came, and they have the highest literacy rate compared to all these other people. So that explains why so many of them end up in top positions. And I did have an ancestor who was in Toronto in this union game, and he happened to be a Scot. Therefore, he was an officer. Therefore, when they lost the strike, he had to leave and crossed into Michigan. So I don't see a nice common pattern, is what I'm saying. That you can say, oh, all the union fellows were sort of alike in their education, whatnot. I don't think it may have been true.
I would agree. I wouldn't disagree with that. There was great variance. What I'm trying to demonstrate is, with what I would call just reflections, is that these connections did exist. They weren't the only pattern that you see. And I would absolutely agree that the Scots are particular with this group. They're overrepresented when it comes to railway engineers. They're overrepresented in everywhere in Canada. Our first two prime ministers were Scottish. So I actually agree with you.
So when that particular individual emigrated or had to leave because they lost the thing and the officers were kicked out, then he went into Michigan. Well, he never got his American citizenship. It wasn't necessary. Therefore, his children, in trying to get a visa to Europe or where they wanted to go, had problems because they didn't have the documents of their father. So it became rather complex.
Thank you very much.